It was excruciating to sit here pretending this was about the Nobel, to watch Melissa try to fix something that was not fixable.
I should have put more effort into appearing on late-night talk shows and wheedling invitations to be guest of honor at science fiction conventions, Ugo said.
Peter sighed heavily.
You got me, Ugo. I won a Nobel Prize because I cozied up to the science fiction community.
Ugo folded his arms.
You painted this image of yourself as a lone wolf genius who did everything by himself. You've done a lot of things behind my back, but research isn't one of them.
Peter tried to mask how badly the insult shook him by trying to look annoyed. He reached for the shaker, poured himself a drink, and spilled half of it on the tablecloth.
What do you mean Peter's done a lot of things behind your back?
Melissa said.
Nothing.
Ugo waved a hand in disgust. Peter certainly did nothing to intentionally get you excluded from sharing the prize. You can't think he would do that, do you?
Ugo looked right at Peter. No. All of Peter's mistakes are accidents.
Peter took a long swig of his drink, trying to mask how badly his hand was shaking.
Why don't we talk about something pleasant?
Out beyond the pool, the setting sun bathed Melissa's miniature golf course in golden light. He pointed toward it. Melissa just finished her 13th hole, Stonehenge. Melissa sprang from her seat.
Let's play it!
Without waiting, she headed down the winding staircase to the pool area. Peter followed, leaving Ugo sitting alone with his drink. Melissa handed Peter a putter and ball, then leaned two spare putters against a bench by the newly completed hole. Peter's ball hit one of the broad, flat stones and ricocheted off to the right. As he turned, he saw Ugo standing with his hands in his pockets, a dozen feet behind them. Melissa's overshot the hole by about 6 feet. Peter headed toward his ball.
Hang on!
Melissa lifted one of the spare putters. Who's going to play for Isabella? Peter froze. Melissa stood holding the club, waiting for one of them to claim it.
I miss her. I know both of you do, too. Maybe you don't realize it, but I think a lot of the problem between you two has to do with her. If she were here, I don't think this falling out would have happened.
Ugo barked a laugh, the harshness of it clearly startling Melissa.
What's funny about that, Ugo?
Peter retrieved the extra putter, his knees shaking badly.
I'll play for Isabella. Let's just get this over with.
As he was setting the orange ball on the mat, the putter was ripped from his hand. He looked up to find Ugo looming over him, clutching the putter.
Don't you dare. I told you to never speak her name in front of me, and I meant it.
Melissa pushed her way between them.
What the hell is going on? Someone tell me, right now.
Peter should have insisted they call the police, that night in his lab. He'd taken the easy way out when Ugo offered it, but in a situation like this, there was no easy anything. Ugo glared at Peter.
Go ahead. Tell her. I'm tired of our friends thinking I'm the villain in this.
He wanted to tell Ugo to shut the hell up. He wanted to run.
Tell me what?
Melissa looked at Peter, frowning, confused. Possibilities must be flying through her head, the worst probably being that he and her sister had had an affair. If only it were that simple.
Better yet, why doesn't Peter tell her?
Ugo looked up at Peter.
Why don't you see if the real Peter can join us, or is he too ill?
The words hit Peter like he'd been punched. Surely Ugo couldn't know. No one knew except his doctor. Melissa looked from Ugo to Peter and back again.
If you're trying to make some sort of profound existential point, Ugo, it's lost on me.
Ugo shrugged.
I'm simply asking if Peter can join us.
He's right there, Melissa nearly shouted.
Ugo shook his head.
That's not Peter.
He looked at Peter, grunted.
I assumed your wife, at least, was in on that secret. You really haven't told her any of this?
How could Ugo possibly know? Dr. Otero wouldn't violate Peter's confidence, would she? If she did, she would have told Melissa, not Ugo.
Ugo tisked, shook his head as if he were disappointed in Peter. Do you really think I'd miss the early symptoms of a disease that my own wife suffers from?
Peter tried to think of when Ugo would have even seen him. The driving range? Peter hadn't even known he had Peterson Jansch that day at the driving range.
Melissa studied Peter, lingered on his quavering hands.
Sweetie, are you sick?
He's not sick. The real Peter is sick. Very sick by now.
Shut up, Melissa said. I'm asking Peter.
She turned to Peter, her eyes pleading.
Tell me what's going on.
Ugo took a seat on the bench beside the 13th hole, leaned back, folding his hands across his belly.
Where should we start?
He cocked his eyebrows.
What is it you think you know? Peter asked.
All right. 2 weeks ago, you were exhibiting the early symptoms of Peterson Jansch. Now,
he gestured toward Peter's hands with a flourish,
they've absolutely vanished. Either you've developed a cure for Peterson Jansch, in which case I'm sure the Nobel Committee will have a prize in medicine and physiology for you in no time, or you duplicated yourself.
Melissa gaped at Ugo.
What are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? It's Peter.
Peter considered denying it all, insisting Ugo had gone off the deep end. Ugo had no proof. Isabella's duplicate body was at the bottom of a shaft deep under the lab. Peter's body was gone. Melissa grasped his arms, her face suddenly close to his.
Do you know what he's talking about? Because you don't look confused. You look terrified, and that's scaring me.
Peter looked at Ugo, who raised and lowered his eyebrows. The bastard was enjoying this.
Can we go sit?
Peter whispered, his voice shaking. He followed Melissa back to the veranda, with Ugo trailing a dozen paces behind. Before he began, he drained his martini glass in 3 big gulps.
Right before she died, Isabella asked me to duplicate her.
He couldn't catch his breath. He felt like he'd just been sprinting.
At first, I said no.
We said no, Ugo interrupted. She asked us together, and we told her no.
Do you want to tell her?
Peter hissed.
Ugo shrugged. If you want. But you're doing fine. Why don't you go on?
Peter wanted to hurl a plate at his bald head. Later, when I was visiting her alone, Isabella begged me to help her. I kept telling her it was too dangerous. She didn't feel she had anything to lose at that point, so I agreed to help her. He looked at the slatted floor, his voice dropping to a near whisper. And she died. Peter knew she'd be shocked, but he wasn't prepared for the utter devastation on Melissa's face. When she'd recovered a little, she turned to Ugo.
You need to go home.
Ugo shrugged, rose from the table.
I understand. It was a shock to me, too, when Peter called me in the middle of the night to tell me my wife was lying dead in his lab.
Please, go,
Melissa said, her voice barely controlled. She was crying, her face down, hidden by the veil of her hair. As Ugo turned, Peter saw the hint of a smirk beneath his somber scowl. He was thrilled by Melissa's reaction. It was exactly what he'd hoped for.
You're such a bastard.
Why don't you buy her some chocolates? That ought to fix things.
Ugo paused, as if considering.
Better yet, give her a bottle of Zing energy drink.
Ugo stood very still, staring pointedly at Peter, as if those words, Zing energy drink, were profoundly significant. Peter watched him wind down the staircase. Her breathing ragged, head still bowed, Melissa waited for Ugo to be gone. Why had Ugo waited so long? If he was going to reveal the truth about Isabella, why wait? The only thing that had changed was Peter had contracted Peterson Jansch. Ugo hadn't been around to see him popping Motrin like mad, drinking Zing because the caffeine helped the headaches. How could he possibly know?
Why don't you give her
a bottle of Zing energy drink. In his mind's eye, Peter saw Ugo jamming a syringe down through the neck of a plastic Zing bottle. So the bottle wouldn't leak, so Peter wouldn't notice the tiny hole when he pulled the bottle from his refrigerator. He inhaled sharply, held his breath. Who had easier access to the Peterson Jans prion than Ugo? He leaned over the rail, shouted, "You did this to me!" Ugo stopped, halfway down the staircase, looked up at Peter and smiled. "I have no idea what you're talking about!" Peter grabbed a steak knife from the table and launched himself down the staircase after Ugo. "Peter!" Peter could hear Melissa chasing him down the iron stairs. That's why Ugo hadn't called the police that night in the lab. If Peter was in prison, Ugo couldn't get to him. "You murdered me!" Peter shouted. "I was only trying to help her, and you murdered me for it!" "Peter!" Ugo was only a few steps below, waiting when he saw Peter had a knife. He took off down the remaining steps with Peter right behind, and Melissa screaming at Peter to stop. When Ugo reached the patio, the big man sprinted for the gate. Rage fueling his steps, Peter chased, but when he had his chance, when Ugo had to slow to open the gate, Peter couldn't bring himself to use the knife. Instead, he slashed at the air a few inches from Ugo's shoulder. Melissa grabbed him from behind and yanked him around. "What are you doing? What's the matter with you? Didn't you hear what he said? He infected me with Peterson Jans." Behind Melissa, the fountain pattered like a heavy downpour. She pressed her hands to her face, dragged them, tugging her skin, exposing the blood-red rings under her eyes. "Why didn't you tell me?" Ugo's Porsche roared to life, backed down the driveway. Was she talking about Isabella? Or Peter's duplication? Had she even caught on yet that he was not the original Peter? She must have. Everything was spinning out of control. Melissa was waiting for an answer. "I was ashamed and afraid. Ugo offered me an out because he didn't want anyone to know how Isabella died. At least, that's what he said." "Did a duplicate of Isabella come out?" "Yes. She was dead as well." He knew what question was coming next, and he dreaded it. "What happened to her body?" Peter put his hands on his head, turned away from Melissa. "I hid it. In the factory." He saw no point in bringing Harry into this. "You dumped my sister's body in a factory?" Melissa sounded horrified, disgusted, just as Peter had imagined every time he thought of telling her. He turned to face her. It wasn't her body. It had never been alive. "So you hid it?" Her eyes were brimming with tears. She reached up, brushed a strand of hair aside with badly trembling fingers. "Yes." Melissa waited. When Peter didn't say anything more, she said, "Go on." "I started getting sick. Headaches. Trembling. Susanna Otero diagnosed me with Peterson Jans. I thought I caught it from Isabella. Now I know the truth." He glanced toward the driveway, although Ugo was long gone. "I needed to finish the Singularity Project. Too many lives are at stake for me not to, so I duplicated myself." It seemed to take time for the words to register. When they did, Melissa broke down. She sank to the pavement, clutching her stomach. When Peter sank to one knee, tried to console her, she shoved him away.
"You're not Peter? Is that what you're telling me?"
"Of course I'm Peter. I remember the first time I set eyes on you, coming out of your trailer on the way to the bus stop in fifth grade. The first time we kissed, outside Regal Cinema, after we saw that Tom Cruise movie.
You're the duplicate, though. That's what you're saying."
Reluctantly, Peter nodded. Melissa stood.
"Where is Peter?"
"I'm Peter." He poked viciously at his chest as he stood to face her. "The only way I could save my life was to create a second me. It was the only way. I duplicated myself, and then I killed myself. My dying self." Melissa cried out, clapped her hand over her mouth. "So there'd be no question that I was me." He reached out with both hands, held her shoulders,
She shook him off as if she'd been touched by snakes. Don't touch me. I'm not married to you. I'm a widow.
Her eyes opened wide for an instant.
Then she laughed harshly. You're not even the Peter who killed my sister and hid the body. You didn't even exist when that happened.
Technically, that's true, but you're wrong. I did do it. I still have nightmares about it. She looked just as she had at Isabella's funeral. Shell-shocked. Gut-punched.
I fell in love with Peter because he was so sweet. So honest.
She wiped her nose with the back of her hand.
Now I'm standing in my backyard hearing about bodies stuffed in basements.
She held her stomach.
God, my stomach hurts. Is this a nightmare? Please, let this be a nightmare.
For a second time, Peter reached out, grasped her shoulder, trying to steady her again. Again, Melissa pushed him away.
Leave! Leave or I'll call the police and tell them what you've done.
Melissa, it's me. It's still me. I didn't mean to do anything wrong. Please, can we figure this out together? Melissa held up a hand in warning, fresh tears wetting her face.
Go!
He went through the gate, to his car, and sat in the driveway, shaking. He'd done everything wrong, made the wrong choice at every turn. The thought of spending even one night away from Melissa right now was intolerable. With everything that was happening, all the stress and fear, Melissa was what kept him sane. The only place he could think to go was Harry's apartment. Chapter 31. Fowler watched Storm, her white shirt flickering in the wind. He wanted to believe she was the woman in the picture, but as she'd said, it was silly to pretend there was no chance it was poor Emily or Susanna. And who knew? There could be more storms. As the hours passed, his concern drifted outside of him until it became something he could put on or take off at will, or turn over in his hands and examine. None of them spoke much. It was like being back in Snakebite's repair shop, only instead of pass me that hammer, it was, do you want some berries? Fowler was glad. Talking broke the spell, dragged him back from that blissful place where he was standing motionless, his thoughts slowing to a stop. He enjoyed watching Storm fall, her hair in a ponytail snapping in the ceaseless wind. He wondered if she was still angry at him for pulling her off her world. It struck him that he'd never really said he was sorry for making that decision for her. He'd explained himself, defended himself, but never apologized, and in all fairness, it should have been her decision to make, even if staying meant dying. Fowler drifted closer to Storm. I'm so sorry, he shouted. I don't know why I tried to defend what I did. All I can say is... The temptation to add that he'd only done it because he cared about her was strong, but that would just be more excuse-making. All I can say is, I'm sorry. Storm's expression told him he'd just gone a ways toward redeeming himself in her eyes.
I'm sorry, too. Fowler frowned.
What did you do? She reached out with one hand. Fowler took it, and they drew together until their faces were close enough that they didn't quite have to shout.
I let you think I was dead.
Fowler shook his head. Only for a moment. That was only because you figured it out. I was going to tell you it was me as soon as I could get you alone. Fowler nodded. And I swear to you, what I did wasn't calculated. I did it without thinking. I'm impulsive sometimes. It gets me into trouble.
Like falling off your world? That kind of trouble?
Like that, yes. They fell past an enormous cloud, taller than it was wide, and drenched in pink and peach from the setting sun. Do you miss Moonlark? Fowler asked. Storm smiled wanly.
I do.
He wasn't my idea of the perfect man, but he'd been a part of my life almost from the beginning. It's strange to think I'll never see him again. Chances were, no one would ever see him again. But Fowler kept that thought to himself. Chapter 32. They fell side by side, but didn't speak much. He was happy just to fall with Storm, to let the wind air out his head, to sweep away the sight of Emily lying dead in Storm's arms, and all the corpses that looked like him. Fuller hadn't realized he'd fallen asleep until Storm's voice woke him. He moved closer to her. "I didn't hear you. I keep wondering about the photo, about Emily and Susanna." "Forget about the photo. I can't. You're the woman in the picture, I know it. But you don't." And they never would. That doubt would always hang over them. "I don't care what we meant to each other in the past. I care about now." He pulled himself closer and kissed her. The kiss missed because of the turbulence, catching part of her lip and a nostril. Storm's expression was unreadable. "Remember how that impulsiveness always gets you in trouble?" Storm grabbed his nose between her thumb and forefinger and twisted until he yelped in pain. Then she let go of his hand and drifted away. Chapter 17. The beeping of the moving van backing into the driveway pulled Peter out of the imaginary conversation he was having with Melissa. He rose from the bench by the 13th hole, went around front. Melissa was just stepping out of her van, wearing sunglasses, her hair pulled back tightly. When she saw him, she looked away. "You promised you'd stay away until I was finished." "I know, I'm sorry. I realized it might be the last time I ever see you." The rims of his eyes were burning from crying earlier.
"I don't even know what to call you," Melissa said.
Peter looked toward the heavens.
"I'm Peter. It's me. It's just me."
One of the movers joined them. "Miss Devereaux, if you'll walk through the house with me, show me what goes."
"Sure."
Peter watched her go. She was wearing black pants, a black silk scarf, as if she were in mourning. He had a terrible thought. What if she held a funeral for him? Surely she wouldn't do that. He was just caught in a spiral of terrible thoughts. He went back to the bench, watched for glimpses of Melissa as the moving men carried furniture out of their house. He tried to watch the clouds, a low ceiling of cumulus and stratocumulus, the tufts tinged in plum purple, but it didn't calm him. Every box, every piece of furniture the moving men carried out burned in the pit of his stomach. But he couldn't stop watching. The French doors opened, and Melissa came out. As she walked toward him, he felt a fresh surge of irrational hope that she was coming to forgive him. The look on her face dashed those hopes. "Do you really believe we're not married? Or are you planning to file for divorce? Last time I checked, I was still legally Peter Sandoval." Melissa pulled her hair back with both hands, lifted her face to the sky.
"I don't even want to think about that now. I want to go home to New York and spend time with friends, but I can't even do that."
No, that was for sure. Parts of New York were under enemy control. Parts of the city were rubble.
"Where are you going to go?"
"I'm staying with Kathleen in D.C.
From the way she was standing, arms folded, shifting from foot to foot, Peter knew she wouldn't be here much longer. If he was going to give the little speech he'd been rehearsing night after night while he wasn't sleeping, now was the time. Not that it would do any good.
"Whatever you think of me, of the things I did, I want you to know I meant well. I only meant to help Isabella. It was the only thing in my heart when I said yes to her."
He took a breath, expecting her to argue, to tell him to shut up, but she only went on staring into the pool.
"When Ugo tried to kill me, all I could think was, I can stop this damned war. If I had more time, I could keep millions of people from dying. You say you married me because I was kind. I still am. I'm a good person. I could have used the singularity to become the richest person on Earth. Instead, I'm risking my life to give it away. Don't you dare try to paint me as some sort of psychopath."
Still staring into the water, Melissa unfolded her arms.
"Okay."
As she started back toward the house, two women wearing black suits and dark sunglasses passed through the gate, heading toward Peter. Melissa paused. When they reached Peter, one of the women held up a badge. "FBI. "Mr. Sandoval, my name is Special Agent Shannon Mitzner, and this is Special Agent Patricia Cortez.
We'd like you to come with us.
Why?
Peter said. We're investigating two suspected murders, Peter Sandoval and Isabella Devereaux-Wolkoff.
Ugo.
I'm Peter Sandoval. Agent Mitzner nodded. It's a complicated matter. Please come with us and we can discuss it.
Why would federal agents be investigating murders?
Peter asked.
There are national security implications to the murder of Peter Sandoval.
Do I have a choice? Am I under arrest?
Yes, I'm afraid you are, Agent Mitzner said.
Peter looked to Melissa for help, for compassion. He didn't know what he wanted from her. She turned and headed for the driveway, sobbing.
This ends Disc 6. Fowler, Disc 7.
Chapter 33. After 2 days of falling, Fowler was just beginning to worry when he spotted another world. Their stores were just about depleted, partly because they'd only counted on there being two of them. He and Storm moved over to join Snakebite. Snakebite stared right through him. At something 1,000 miles away, Fowler tapped his shoulder. Slowly, Snakebite's eyes regained focus. Fowler pointed at the world. Snakebite nodded. Moving quickly, he and Storm strapped themselves into the harness together and deployed their single chute. It was small, a U-shaped sliver, nothing but wreckage and rubble. Melted vehicles, piles of bricks and concrete, twisted steel beams. It reminded Fowler of the bombed-out part of his own world. Fowler and Storm came down hard in a pile of bricks. The falling chute drifted past them and crumpled. Fowler watched as Snakebite kept drifting.
Shit!
Fowler shrugged out of the harness and ran after Snakebite, who was heading toward the edge.
Look out! He cried, as if he couldn't see he was in trouble.
Snakebite reached out and hooked his arm around a steel beam, part of the blackened skeleton of a high-rise 30 feet above the ground. The velocity almost tore away his grip, but Snakebite clung tight, the muscles in his arm tensing as the parachute collapsed, fluttering and dropping limply. Fowler and Storm waited at the bottom as Snakebite shimmied down.
Can you tell me what I did wrong so I'll know not to do it again?
Snakebite asked as he examined abrasions on his arms. Fowler thought about it.
Aim for the middle.
Snakebite grunted. They found a handful of bodies, all but one wrapped in blankets and set in a neat row in the lobby of a mostly intact hotel. The last body was propped against a concrete traffic divider right by the edge. They were little more than skeletons in clothes. There were buckets, plastic tarps, bathtubs set out all around the hotel, and no obvious source of water, so not much mystery about how they died. They found a few empty cans, one a can of peaches that reminded Fowler of Daisy.
I guess it's safe to assume this isn't the world we're looking for, Storm said.
Why don't we head toward the edge? Fowler was eager to find the X on his map. They could sleep in shifts while they fell. Fowler caught his ankle on the steel post of a bent-over sign, still fixed in the broken concrete. As he pulled his foot free, he noticed the image on the sign. It was a tower, twice as tall as those around it, its surface formed so it looked as if it had been twisted. It was wider at the bottom, tapered at the top, crowned with a long metal pole resembling a spear. There was an arrow on the sign pointing to the left. When the sign was standing upright, it would be pointing right off the edge. Fowler bent, gripped the sign in both hands, then brushed dirt caked over the top of the tower. He knew that building like he knew his own face.
How did I miss it before? He said aloud.
Storm bent beside him, looked at the sign.
What is it?
It's the tower, the skyscraper I jumped from. This sign is pointing to a building on my world.
How could...
She began, then gasped as realization dawned. He could picture exactly where this little sliver of world would fit up against his, over a divot that jutted out over the edge in the bombed-out section of his world.
Someone or something tore the world apart.
It caused all this suffering, the hunger, the purges. I want to know who or what did this.
Fowler pulled out his map, unfolded it.
That's what the X is for, to show us where to find the answer.
Chapter 18. Peter went to his filing cabinet, rummaged around until he found the bottle of tequila they'd presented to him at the surprise birthday party the lab had thrown for him last year. He was tempted to drink straight from the bottle, but there were still dozens of people moving around the lab at 2 a.m., so he opted for a mug commemorating the 87th International Conference on Theoretical Physics. That had been a good conference. He took a swig of the tequila, felt it burn as it trailed down his esophagus. The bail hearing still haunted his exhausted brain. They'd declared Peter Sandoval dead. The prosecutor had referred to Peter in the past tense. He took another swig of tequila. He hadn't eaten in 3 days, had barely been able to get water past the fist of anguish lodged in his throat. He wondered what Melissa was doing. It still didn't seem real that he couldn't pick up the phone and call her. Tell her what a crappy day he was having. Tell her how much he loved her. She was never coming back. The alcohol provided a distance and clarity that allowed him to see that. Melissa was never coming back. They weren't even legally married. She was a widow. The door to the lab whooshed open. Peter half stood to see who it was as Kathleen breezed in. His first thought was she was here with a message from Melissa, but why would Melissa send Kathleen on a 3-hour drive from D.C. rather than call Peter herself? Or send a text? He raised his hand and waved to Kathleen. She stopped in his doorway, took in the tequila, then, laughing, raised what was in her hand, a bottle of Jack Daniels. Great minds think alike. Peter motioned toward an empty chair. What are you doing in Williamsburg? I came to see you. She half-filled a plastic cup with whiskey. How did you know I'd be in the lab at 2 a.m.? Kathleen chuckled. A lucky guess? I would have tried your house next. Peter laughed, though there was no amusement in the laugh. And it didn't feel good the way laughing used to feel. Sipping his drink, Peter looked out at the duplicator, so full of promise to change the world for the better, yet the cause of all his problems. She's never coming back, is she? It was a complete non sequitur, but Kathleen didn't blink. She doesn't talk about it, so I don't know what she's thinking, but no, I don't think she is. Peter went to the window, stared out into the darkness. She's why I'm still here at 2 a.m. On those nights when I'm too tired to work, I sleep here because I don't want to go home. I should sell that house. But every time I think of doing it, I convince myself she'll be back, and the house will go back to being a good place. Booze dribbled into his mug. Peter turned to find Kathleen refilling it. Thanks. She lifted the bottle in salute, sat again. It took her a moment to find a satisfactory place to set the bottle down on the floor. Evidently, some spots were better than others, or at least that was what Kathleen's OCD told her. She does the best Mick Jagger impersonation you've ever seen. She pulls over on highways to carry toads out of harm's way. She wears Green Lantern pajamas. I really fucked things up. Kathleen sighed, crossed her legs. If you want my opinion, you get 60% of the blame for the breakup, mostly because you're the dumbest genius on the planet for thinking Ugo would keep quiet. Melissa gets 40% for holding you to an impossible standard. She wants to be married to Galahad, Gandhi and Prince Charming all rolled into one. She shook her head. You know what's ironic? Peter took a deep, huffing breath. No. You're about as close as it gets, and she can't even see that. Yeah. He closed his eyes, because her words, despite their good intention, hurt. Once upon a time, he'd thought that highly of himself. Now, it sounded like the sort of lie you'd tell a depressed friend to cheer him up. You said you came all this way to see me? Believe it or not, I'm here to deliver an offer from the president. Peter raised his eyebrows. Wow, you've come up in the world. Last I heard, you were sharing an office, drafting PR releases. Kathleen waved the compliment away. She asked me to do it because I know you personally. He leaned forward, laced his fingers over his knee. So, do tell. What does President Aspen want? Peter had little doubt about the nature of the offer. They had him over a barrel. Turn the duplicator over to the U.S. government. Teach our people everything you know about it. In exchange, you get a full pardon. Just the duplicator. Not the singularity? Kathleen tisked. Peter, she doesn't know about the singularity. I don't betray my friends. I was guessing one of the four physicists working with me would have cracked by now. If she knew about it, she'd have already taken this facility, by force if necessary. Peter frowned. What does she want the duplicator for, if not to create a singularity? I don't need to tell you that we're taking heavy, heavy losses out west and in Europe. She wants to make more soldiers. Peter jolted. Some of the tequila in his glass splashed on his fingers. She wants to... Peter pictured the same soldier, obviously one with high intelligence and superior battlefield skills, being spit from a duplicator over and over, day and night. They'd feed duplicates of him back in like a conga line. This isn't only about the war for her, Kathleen said. Aspen is seriously worried about a coup. I'm sure you've seen General Elba trashing Aspen in the media. She's testing the waters, seeing how people would react. That frail dove doesn't have the stomach to do what needs to be done, Ugo had said at the driving range. Ugo's involved in this, isn't he? Big time, Kathleen said. He seems to be getting more powerful in that camp by the day. Peter wondered if he should take the deal, sick as the image of a million twin soldiers made him. Did he have a choice? They'd probably take the duplicator by force if he didn't agree. The president was playing relatively nice for now because it wasn't just about the duplicator itself. His expertise was valuable as well. Even if he did have a choice, it was probably unpatriotic, even treasonous, to withhold this advantage from his country because they were going to lose without the singularity. China and India were mauling Russia, bombing Moscow and St. Petersburg mercilessly. But if he had to bet his life on the outcome, he wouldn't bet the home team. If he were forced to hand the singularity over to one country, it would be the U.S. and its allies. But he was convinced the best route was to release it to everyone at once. I'm guessing you think I should take the deal? Kathleen propped her foot on his chair. Oh, no, definitely not. She burst out laughing at Peter's dumbfounded reaction. They're afraid of you, Peter. She raised her non-existent eyebrows. You do realize that, don't you? You've cracked reality open like an egg. No one knows what you're capable of. That's why they're leaning on you, trying to pressure you instead of simply coming in and taking what they want. They don't know about the singularity, but I doubt it would surprise them. It seemed impossible that they were having this conversation. Peter wouldn't kill innocent people, not for any reason. That his own government would murder him seemed almost as inconceivable. Kathleen leaned forward, narrowed her eyes. Do you think you could turn DC into a crater if you wanted to? Peter shrugged. Maybe. I never would. Plus, I'm focused on tapping the singularity as an energy source, not developing it as a weapon. I know. That's why I'm telling you all this. If she knew about the singularity, Aspen would immediately develop it into a weapon. I like your plan better. She whispered, better, better, under her breath. It's interesting. Peter took another swig. You're ruthless, but your ruthlessness is driven by good intentions. It's an oxymoronic combination, but you pull it off admirably. Kathleen gave him a wry smile. I'll take that as a compliment. He'd just called Kathleen ruthless. It was probably a sign he should stop drinking. He lifted his mug, took another swig. I'd seriously recommend you hire a private security force to protect this facility. I can hook you up with people you can trust. Peter did not miss the warning in her tone. I'm not sure I can afford it. I need cash. I'm burning through what Constantinides and his billionaire friends have given me. The war is making it hard for them to stay liquid. I'm working on finding you more, with Melissa's help. Melissa? Kathleen nodded. I wish you were working for me. I could use help navigating the political side of things. Kathleen stood, spread her arms for a hug. When the time is right, I'll come. For now, I'm more valuable to you in Washington. Feeling somewhat wobbly, Peter stood and wrapped his arms around her. Thank you so much. She kissed him, full on the mouth, but briefly, then stepped away and capped her bottle of Jack. I'll be in touch. Be careful. Be paranoid. Chapter 34. It was night when Fowler spotted the next world, blotting out a patch of stars beneath their feet. He couldn't make out much of this world in the darkness, but as they dropped, the shadows of medium-tall buildings loomed to his left. Off to his right were bizarre things he wasn't sure he recognized, yet they tugged at him, called to him in a peculiar way. Naked loops snaked through the sky. Skeletal steel towers like big ladders rose. A giant wheel. Ferris wheel, his mind whispered. Yes, that was it. Fowler could remember that a Ferris wheel turned and that people sat in it, but not why. Looking at it gave him an all-too-familiar falling sensation in the pit of his stomach. They dropped onto a wide, flat, chewed-up four-lane road, with no buildings in sight, the tandem landing with storm once again jarring. Along with food and water, Fowler needed to find materials to make Storm her own chute. Once their chutes were stashed away in their packs, they came together in the middle of the highway. Which way? Fowler asked, looking around. Storm pointed. I want to see the amusement park. Amusement park? That's what it was called. Do you know what it does? Storm looked at him like he was the dimmest sop she'd ever seen. She set her palm on his forehead and gave a gentle shove before setting off toward the amusement park. I'm guessing it amuses. For a moment, he just watched her go. Then he caught up to Snakebite. They were approaching an enormous overhead road sign with nothing on it but words. Fowler stared at the words, squinting. They're as familiar as my own hand. I know they form words, but no matter how much I struggle, I can't make them speak. Snakebite considered the sign. So many of the words I know don't mean anything, Fowler said. Italy, Snakebite said. Exactly. Boot? It's a kind of boot, I think. Snakebite shook his head. It's a white building with marble poles in front. That seemed right as well. Maybe it was one of those words that meant more than one thing, like orange. I used to think a lot of the words I knew were imaginary, like the talking animals in comic books. But the more I see, the more I believe they're all real. Snakebite pointed at the behemoth structures rising above the trees ahead. Ferris wheel. Roller coaster. I've never seen one before, but there they are. A flash of insight came to Fowler. You ride them. Snakebite thought about it, then nodded. That's right. You ride them. For amusement. They passed another sign, this one big and colorful, set among dead bamboo trees. Farther on was the biggest expanse of pavement Fowler had ever seen, then a high fence and sheltered gates. The gates were open. The sun was rising as they passed into the amusement park. There was no one in sight. Straight ahead, the roller coaster sat behind a low fence. It was an enormous beast, a mad set of twisting, looping train tracks. Seeing it up close, it was obvious to Fowler that you rode it, although it clearly didn't go anywhere. They passed a fenced-in field, littered with bones and rotting pieces of brown and white fur. Snakebite pointed to a sign mounted on the fence that sported a picture. Giraffes! Yet another thing Fuller had suspected was nothing but a fantasy. Evidently this world was inhabited because the giraffes looked like they'd been eaten. He wished he could see one alive. There was a pirate ship, dozens of well-plundered stores, empty booths with pictures of delicious-looking non-existent foods. People began to appear here and there. A few glanced their way, but no one paid them any special attention. They passed a small train on a circular track, a merry-go-round, toy planes on the ends of steel poles also set in a circle. Ahead, they heard the murmur of voices. A market was in progress, tables of goods set out in an open, cobblestoned area surrounded by squat brown and white buildings with a clock tower in the center. Hands in their pockets, they strolled along, studying the goods and the transactions.
"Do you have anything for me today?"
Paula looked up. An old woman was standing behind a table of herbs and vegetables, looking at Storm expectantly. Her bright red hair was silver at the roots. When Storm didn't answer, the woman added,
"Who are your friends?"
Storm kept her expression flat and matter-of-fact. "This is Fowler and Snakebite." Fowler nodded hello. The old woman smiled and nodded back. Over the old woman's shoulder, Fowler spotted a woman on a bicycle cruising toward them, her arms covered in colorful tattoos, her long black hair snapping in the breeze. She kept the bike remarkably steady as she weaved among people and merchandise.
"Why are you dressed like that?"
the old woman asked.
"And what's with the packs? Are you—"
The woman on the bicycle looked up, locked eyes with Fowler, and shrieked. She slammed into a tall steel rack of homemade shoes, knocking them everywhere. She tumbled across the cobblestones before coming to rest against the legs of a table. Fowler rushed to help her. She had a long, ugly scrape up her arm from elbow to shoulder. The knee of her pant leg was torn and streaked with blood. "Are you all right?" She looked at him, seemed baffled by the question. Storm, Snakebite, the brown-skinned man who evidently owned the shoes, and a few others hovered over them. "Can you stand?"
"I don't know,"
the woman said. She had a peculiar voice, high-pitched and warbly. Fowler helped her as she got to her knee and stood. When her right foot touched the ground, she yelped in pain and buckled into Fowler's arms. Snakebite squatted, rolled up her pant leg, and examined her ankle.
"There's no swelling." "It hurts," the woman said. "I think it might be broken."
"Come on, let's find some cool water for it," Fowler said. Snakebite grasped the woman's other arm while Storm got her bicycle.
"Which way?" he asked the injured woman. "I live in Wild West Town."
She was looking up the paved trail leading out of the square, so Fowler headed in that direction, not wanting to let on that they had no idea where or what Wild West Town was. The woman hopped along on one foot, leaning heavily on Fowler and Snakebite. Her tattoos started at the wrist, disappeared up the short sleeves of a loose orange blouse. The ones on Fowler's side were a tapestry of thorny roses, young and old faces, words, and abstract designs. They were like someone's dream, chaotic, nightmarish, yet beautiful. There were lines in the corner of her eyes and on her forehead, setting her about square in the middle between young and old.
"It would be easier on your ankle if I carry you," Snakebite suggested.
"I'd rather you didn't, if you don't mind. I appreciate the offer, but the worse off I seem, the more likely someone notices and takes advantage, you know."
Snakebite nodded.
"I'm Penny, by the way."
Fowler, Storm, and Snakebite introduced themselves.
"I've seen you around," she said to Storm, "but not Fowler or Snakebite. Are you two from the other end?"
"We are."
Fowler could have sworn Penny had shrieked at the sight of him. It reminded Fowler of the first time Bruce saw him. Maybe something had happened to her bike at that moment, and that's why she'd shrieked.
"Were you driven out, or are you just here to trade?"
"Just to trade," Fowler said. Driven out? That didn't sound promising. He hoped they weren't in for a replay of Storm's world. At least this time, no one saw them fall from the sky, and they weren't defenseless. They reached a fork in the road. Fuller allowed Penny's hopping to draw them to the right. "What happened back there?" he asked.
"Oh," she waved in the air, "I was going too fast. I hit something slick and the tire went out from under me."
It had looked to Fowler like she barreled straight into the shoe shelf, but he kept his opinion to himself. They passed under a rickety wooden sign that, along with words, sported the silhouette of a cowboy. Beyond was a dirt road running between old unpainted buildings made of rough-cut planks. Here and there, bicycles were tied to wooden railings. The only vegetation in sight, if you could call it vegetation, was a big dead tree poking up through the planked sidewalk on one side of the street. There weren't many people around.
"This is me up there,"
Penny gestured at a staircase clinging precariously to the outside of one of the rustic buildings. They helped her up the steps, which creaked ominously. From the landing, Fowler could see they were fairly close to the edge, maybe 1,000 steps away. A sweeping, raised, semicircular track ended abruptly, jutting out into space. Penny fished a key out of the back pocket of the baggy pants she was wearing and unlocked the door. Her apartment was packed with useless things. Rows of dolls lined the shelves of one bookcase, some of them soiled and worn. One, a man dressed in a black tuxedo sitting beside the shelf, was life-sized. There were stuffed animals of every size, and shelf after shelf of books. The walls were covered with paintings of nothing more than blotches of color. "Will you be all right here?" Fowler was eager to look around, find some food and water, plus materials to fashion a parachute.
"No!" Penny nearly shouted.
More calmly, she added,
"Please don't go. I'm sure I'll be fine in a day or two, but right now I can barely walk."
"Don't you have a friend who could help you?" Storm asked. Penny looked slightly embarrassed as she answered,
"That depends on what you mean by a friend."
Fowler looked at the others, not sure what to do.
"I have food," Penny offered.
Fowler wasn't sure he had the heart to leave Penny in any case, but the promise of a meal clinched it for them. While Snakebite went to the kitchen to get a meal started, Fowler stepped onto the outside landing with Storm. "What do you think?" he asked.
"I can stay with Penny while she recovers, so there's no chance of me bumping into my newest twin."
It was clear the prospect of yet another lookalike didn't sit well with Storm. Fowler could relate. "We're near the edge, so if we run into problems, we can leave in a hurry. You and Snakebite could see about restocking our food supply. Plus, we need to make a parachute for you. Not more than a couple of days, though."
"No, 2 or 3 at most," Storm said.
They made 2 new parachutes, one for Storm, plus an emergency backup in case one got damaged. With the chutes safely stashed in their packs, they sat in Penny's living room as the light faded. "You've got an interesting apartment. The decorations, I mean," Fowler said, working to keep the conversation on innocuous things that would avoid exposing their ignorance of her world. Rubbing her sore ankle, Penny looked around the room.
"They're all carnival prizes. They were just lying around in bins inside the games. I went around and collected a bunch."
She shrugged.
"They're comforting to me. I don't know why."
"They're soft and innocent," Storm said, smiling. "I think we all craved friendly faces, especially in the early days." "What about the books?" Fowler asked. One of the first things he'd done when he claimed his room on day one was dump all the books out the window.
"Oh, they were already here," Penny waved dismissively.
They kept the conversation light and vague. Their greatest food discoveries in the early days. Speculations about the origins of day one. Penny told them about her day one experience. She woke in the park, huddled on a bench by the elephants. She told them what elephants had been like, and giraffes and zebra. She didn't ask them any hard questions that might expose their ignorance of the world, probably eager to please so they'd stick around until her ankle healed. She was nervous, constantly twirling her hair or biting her nails, but quick to laugh.
"So are you and Snakebite planning to go back to the other end when you leave here?"
she asked Fowler when the light had almost completely drained from the room.
"It's safer here in the park."
Fowler looked at Snakebite.
We're not sure what our plans are. We tend to move around a lot.
The reason I ask, Penny said, is because I could really use some friends. And I like you, all of you.
She looked at each of them in turn.
I feel like I can trust you.
Fowler gave Penny a warm smile, feeling like shit, as Storm muttered something vague about seeing how things unfolded. When it was so dark they couldn't see each other's faces, Penny announced that she was spending the night right where she was on the couch, and they were welcome to the bed in her bedroom. Snakebite grabbed his pack and unrolled his blanket on the floor in the kitchen. Storm headed toward the bedroom. At the door, she turned to Fowler.
Are you coming?
Chapter 35.
Stop grinning. It makes people suspicious, Snakebite said.
He couldn't help it. Whenever he wasn't thinking about his mouth, it immediately formed a wide smile. He'd never felt so light and warm. It was as if he'd now emptied 2/3 of the objects he'd found in his pocket on day one. He'd gotten off his world and had reunited with the woman he'd lost. Only the map was left to weigh him down. Snakebite whacked his chest, not hard, but hard enough.
Stop grinning!
Snakebite was always looking around, scanning in every direction. Fowler thought he must be watching for threats, but then another explanation occurred to him.
You're watching for your children.
Snakebite went on scanning.
Only way I'm going to find them.
I'll keep an eye out, too. When they had some privacy, he'd have to take a closer look at their photos, although he thought he'd recognize them from their complexions and angular faces. The market was, if anything, busier than the previous day. The old woman with the herbs and vegetables was there. So was the man selling shoes, his merchandise looking no worse for wear. The thing was, all Fowler and Snakebite had to offer in trade were guns and ammunition. Even if they kept 2 guns for each of them, they had 2 to spare. If this world was anything like his, or Storm's, a gun was worth a great deal of food. But it wasn't something you simply pulled out in a marketplace. It would draw unwanted attention. As it was, people kept eyeing Snakebite. He was the sort of man you didn't forget, and suddenly, everyone on this world was seeing him for the first time. I think our best bet is to find a rough neighborhood, assuming this world has one. Fowler looked at Snakebite. You didn't have a rough part of town on your world, did you?
My house was the rough part of town.
Fowler laughed. Hold on a minute, I've got an idea. Fowler paused as he reached the old woman's table, gave her his brightest smile. I'm wondering if you've seen my friend today? The woman I was with yesterday?
Melissa? Nope. Have you checked if she's working?
Fowler set his hands on the table, leaned in, lowered his voice. To be honest, I don't know her that well. I just met her yesterday, and she took off after helping Snakebite and me take Penny home. The woman smiled slyly.
And you're hoping to bump into her again?
Fowler covered his eyes, feigning embarrassment. You caught me. Can you blame me, though? The woman put a hand on Fowler's shoulder.
If you don't know where Melissa works, you need to get out more.
She gave him directions to a theater on the edge of the amusement park.
You going to go up and introduce yourself?
Snakebite asked as they walked. Fowler laughed. Just a little reconnaissance. If there's another Storm on this world, I want to see her with my own eyes. The lookalikes are the only clue we seem to have about what's going on. They passed a group of 7 men, 3 carrying rifles. The men slowed and eyed them as they passed. Fowler smiled and nodded. Snakebite acted as if he didn't notice them, even as they had to leave the path to let the men by. Fowler heard a voice in the distance, clear and strident, almost singing, but not quite. They were on the paved walk. The open-air pavilion the merchant woman had directed them to was just ahead.
Where are you, Robert? Turn your back on your people, or if you won't, tell me you love me and I'll turn my back on mine.
Her voice was unmistakable as she all but shouted the words with such eloquence, such passion. It set his heart racing to hear it. Fowler picked up his pace as a male voice called out,
Tell me more, or should I answer now? What is a clan, really? Melissa replied.
It's not a hand or a foot. It's just a word. What's a word, really? If you called a rose by any other name, it would smell just as sweet.
The pavilion, nothing but a wide roof, supported by posts, was packed. The perimeter was roped off. Fowler lifted the rope, and he and Snakebite ducked under. A tall man with a machete intercepted them.
You have to pay first.
The man gestured toward a little white booth just outside the pavilion.
You would be just as perfect.
Melissa stopped speaking, mid-sentence. Fowler looked toward Melissa. She was staring right at him, her lovely face filled with such shock, such horror. Her mouth was moving, but no words came. The man on the stage with her stammered some line, trying to cover for her, but Melissa went on staring as the audience began to rumble. She leaped from the low stage and ran, as if she were running for her life. Chapter 19. There were so many bombers, so perfectly spaced, that it looked as if there were a steel mesh curtain gliding over Boston. Peter could barely breathe as skyscrapers crumpled in on themselves.
I can't take this, Harry said, pressing the heels of his hands against his eyeballs. I can't take this anymore, holy Christ!
Peter put a hand on Harry's neck, gave it a gentle squeeze.
I know, hang on, buddy.
The North Korean bombers just kept coming. The same image was echoed on each of the big screens mounted along the factory wall. While the rest of the East Coast was dealing with rolling blackouts every 3 hours, they could watch as many TVs as they cared to, could light the factory floor like it was Christmas time, because their generators were fueled by the singularity. If they would just give him time, he could do it for everyone on Earth. Jill Sanders was sobbing. She'd grown up in Boston.
We're not going to be done in time, Harry said.
Then we have to get it done faster. Maybe he should turn it over to the feds. Their resources were almost endless. His were anything but.
Dr. Sandoval?
Peter turned to find Denny DeRosa, one of his other physicists, running toward him. The prototype arrived. Peter turned his face to the ceiling and shouted with joy and relief. Finally.
They're loading it onto the winch at the south end of the building, DeRosa said. It should be down here in half an hour.
Peter's phone rang. It was Kathleen.
How's your progress? She asked with no preamble.
Someone on the floor called Peter's name. He gestured to Harry to go see what whoever it was wanted, then headed upstairs to make sure the prototype made it down safely.
Better now. I don't want to jinx us, but I think we're a month away. Work on 80 of the platforms is underway, with the other 56 scheduled to begin this week. Our engineers in Germany just delivered the fuel cell prototype, and if our test charge is successful, they're ready to start manufacturing them immediately.
There's something you need to be aware of. Kathleen's tone made Peter's stomach clench.
What's that?
Secretary of Defense Elba and her joint chiefs, Perez, Holland, and Ugo Wolkoff, tried to issue a press release stating Aspen was unfit to serve as commander-in-chief. Aspen blocked the release.
Ugo.
How had that bastard suddenly become a joint chief?
Are they strong enough to push her out?
Peter asked as he climbed a dank, dimly lit staircase.
At this point, it's hard to say who holds more power, Aspen or the military.
You're going to get a call from the president in a little while. She's going to ask you to provide her with the means to manufacture her own duplicator.
What? No, there's no time.
He lowered his voice as he pushed open the heavy door, stepped out into the hallway leading to the main lab.
What if she finds out about the singularity? No.
Just wanted to give you a heads up.
I appreciate it. I won't ever forget this.
Hands on hips, Peter surveyed the lab. It looked like a marine barracks. Security people, his own private army, really, were communicating with others outside the campus perimeter with headsets. A few techs weaved among them, going about their own business, oblivious to what was going on below ground. There were so many pieces of this to keep track of, so many details. Peter hated details, but he needed to get them all right. So much depended on it. Chapter 36. Fowler raced around the edge of the pavilion with Snakebite on his heels. He spotted Melissa running down the walkway the way they'd come. She cut onto a narrower path behind a toy elephant ride, glanced over her shoulder.
Wait! Fowler shouted. I want to talk to you.
Why was she running? She must recognize him or
someone who looked like him. There must be someone on this world who looked like him, someone Penny didn't know. They were closing on her. She hadn't gotten much of a lead, and her long, flowing white dress and matching shoes weren't conducive to speed. Seeing them close behind, Melissa raced up a half-dozen steps and disappeared through a wide doorway. Barreling through the doorway, Faller slammed into a pane of glass and fell on his ass as a dozen Melissas fanned out in different directions. "Are you all right?" Snakebite gripped his armpits and helped him to his feet. He'd struck the window with the side of his face, which throbbed. His cheek stung when he touched it. His fingertips came away somewhat bloody. "I guess so. Come on." Faller headed into the maze more carefully, his arms outstretched. It was a baffling mix of windows and mirrors, all coated in a relatively uniform layer of dust and grime. Melissa was in 50 places at once. He had no idea how to reach her. "Melissa?" All of the Melissa's heads turned when she heard her name. "Melissa, I'm not sure I understand what's going on, but I promise you I'm not out to hurt you." He glanced at Snakebite. "And my friend Snakebite looks scary, but he's harmless too." "I know who you are," Melissa said. "Who am I? I'm dying to know." "Melissa," a voice near the entrance shouted, "are you all right?" Reflections of 5 or 6 men filled a dozen mirrors. One was the man who'd been on stage with Melissa. "Planter," Melissa called, "help me." "Help you? I just told you we just want to talk. You don't need help." Fuller's words were partially drowned by shouts as the men bulled their way into the maze. 2 came around a corner, spotted Faller and Snakebite. Suddenly, Snakebite was pointing a handgun at the oncoming men. "Everyone calm down!" The men froze. "Melissa, stand still!" Snakebite eyed Melissa through the maze, his threat unspoken. Melissa froze. Faller didn't think Snakebite was the sort of man who'd shoot people who weren't pointing guns at him, but he sure looked like the sort who would. "Now Faller is going to come to you. He'd like to ask you a few questions, then he and I are going to leave. No one is going to get hurt, all right?" After a pause, Melissa said, "Yes." "Thanks," Faller muttered to Snakebite. "So much for keeping a low profile." Faller slid his hands along the glass, worked his way through the maze until the flesh and blood Melissa was standing in front of him, her back against a mirror. "Please, just explain who you think I am." Melissa was quivering, as if she were sure Faller was about to kill her. He'd forgotten about the photograph. He took it from his pocket and held it out. "Can you make any sense of this?" Melissa came off the glass, took a half step toward Faller, looked into his eyes. "You've got to be kidding me." She took the photo from him, turned it over, then back again. "You recognize it?" "How the hell did you get here?" she whispered. Faller took the toy paratrooper out of his pocket. Melissa pressed her palms over her eyes and started to laugh. It wasn't happy, joyful laughter, more the sort of laughter Faller associated with lunatics. "I can't get rid of you. You're like a disease that keeps coming back." She dropped her hands. "I thought you were one of Ugo's assassins, coming to get me. Jill and I decided to hide on the same island. They caught her. They almost caught me." She kept her voice low, evidently so the others couldn't hear. Melissa studied him. "Jill Sanders? Your colleague?" Faller shook his head. All of the hostile bravado drained from Melissa's face. "Oh, no." She covered her mouth with one hand. "The virus got you." "The virus? It was a disease?" She was crying. "Yes and no. A disease and a weapon." She shook her head. "Shit, Peter." "My name is Faller," he insisted, although he was getting a terrible sinking feeling. He almost didn't want to ask, but he had to know. "Is that you in the picture?" "Yeah, That was taken on our honeymoon. Costa Rica. We asked a local to take it." "We're married?" Melissa's laughter was bitter. "No, sweetie. We're divorced." Faller felt his heart break. He thought of Storm, waiting back at Penny's apartment. "That can't be. You're lying." "I'm lying?" She held up her left hand, wiggled her finger. "Where's your ring?" She held up the photo, tapped the image of Faller's hand around her waist. "You have it on in the photo." Paula had no idea what a ring had to do with any of this. Why do you remember and I don't?
It's a long story.
He motioned toward the front.
Come on, you can tell me over a meal.
She didn't move.
You're going to get us both killed.
Ugo's looking for us, for you especially. And you're moving from place to place like an idiot.
He couldn't believe this was the woman in the photo.
She was so jaded.
That's why I have to know what's happened. I don't want to get myself killed, or anyone else for that matter. If I'm doing something ignorant, convince me to stop.
She folded her arms, looked away, then dropped her arms and stormed off, navigating the mirrored maze effortlessly. As they returned to Penny's apartment, Melissa walking between Fowler and Snakebite, Snakebite handed Melissa the photos of his children.
Have you seen any of them?
Melissa studied each photo carefully.
I'm sorry, no. If they weren't on your island, they could be on any one of 10,000, more.
Snakebite remained stone-faced as he digested this nugget. Fowler was dreading the moment Storm learned she wasn't the woman in the photo. For his part, Fowler was trying to sort out how this new information affected his feelings for Storm. It did, and it didn't. It didn't change who Storm was, but knowing their coming together was all predicated on a case of mistaken identity was disturbing. He and Melissa were divorced. All of that time, he'd spent mooning over that photo, yearning to find her. Early on, it had been the only thing that kept him going.
What should we do about Penny?
Snakebite asked as they approached the apartment.
That was a good point. They could ask Storm to come outside and leave Penny out of it, but then anyone passing would see Storm and Melissa together, and that might raise eyebrows.
I say we risk telling her the truth, Snakebite said.
Who's Penny? Melissa asked.
A woman we met from your world, Fowler said. Melissa only nodded. At Penny's door, Fowler took a deep breath before pushing it open. Storm, who was sitting on the couch across from Penny, gave him a bright smile as he stepped through. When Melissa followed, she sprang from the couch. Penny looked from Melissa to Storm and back again.
I don't understand. What is this?
For her part, after looking Storm up and down, Melissa only shook her head as if Storm's presence were only mildly surprising.
This is Melissa, Fowler began. Apparently she knows some things and has been kind enough to enlighten us.
Can someone please tell me what's going on?
Penny's voice was shaking.
Fowler held up both hands. Please, Penny, just bear with us.
He turned to Storm. Melissa claims she's the woman in the photo. Storm blinked rapidly, trying to keep her reaction from showing. But it did show, at least to Fowler.
You're sure?
Storm asked Melissa. You remember? Melissa looked at the ceiling.
All too well.
Fowler went to Storm, put a hand across her shoulders, and as gently as possible said, Melissa and I are divorced. Storm covered her mouth and ran into the bathroom. Melissa was gaping at Fowler in disbelief.
You're in love with her?
She looked as if her legs might give out, like she might cry, laugh, scream, or do all three at once. Fowler didn't respond.
Would you mind telling us who you are and why you remember what Fowler doesn't?
Snakebite said, folding his arms across his broad chest. Her hand trembling badly, Melissa swept her hair back, clearly trying to compose herself.
As I told Fowler, it's a long story.
Why don't you get started? Snakebite said.
Wait a minute.
Fowler went to the bathroom door, rapped on it gently.
Storm, you're going to want to hear this.
The door opened. Storm looked composed, her expression unreadable.
Thank you.
Melissa took a seat in a white stuffed chair. Snakebite set a cup of water on the table beside her and took a seat on the floor against the wall. Fowler led Storm to the couch, his heart thumping, sensing that some of the confusion he'd lived with since day one was about to be lifted. Melissa stared at him and Storm.
This is just... I can't believe what I'm seeing.
Please,
Snakebite prodded. Melissa pressed her fingers against the sides of her nose and closed her eyes.
There was a war. Peter and I...
She cleared her throat. Excuse me, Faller and I were active in the war on the losing side, so according to the winning side, we're war criminals. She opened her eyes, looked at Faller and Storm. I guess it makes sense if you've been lobotomized. Lobotomies seem sexy. Pinching his lower lip, Faller waited for her to continue. He had no intention of interrupting this. The war went on until a scientist on the enemy side, Ugo Wolkoff, developed a weapon. It was called the blackout virus. It spread like a disease, but instead of making you sick, it erased your memory. And just like that, the mystery of day one came clear.